the Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. And let me just begin by saying that this hearing is held consistent with House Rule 10.01, which establishes that during a peacetime emergency, it allows for committee procedures for member debate and voting by means of distance voting and/or remote electronic voting. all the members by now, we've been doing this for almost 2 weeks, should be pretty familiar with the best way for us to manage working in this virtual space. The important things are make sure that you're muted when you're not speaking. I believe the host, which is our staff, will automatically mute, but if you can just check to make sure so that we don't have echo and disturbance in the transmission. Also, if there are questions, if you can use the participant icon at the bottom of your Zoom. I'm not sure how you do this if you're calling in. I may need to ask staff for help for that. But the icon will then allow you to do a virtual raising of your hand. Once the staff sees that, they'll take your hand out, but you will be on a list for question answering or question and comments. We do have testifiers at this hearing. Testifiers will be placed in a waiting room and will then be pulled up at the moment in which their testimony is to be given. The entire proceeding is telecast on our live stream at the Minnesota House website. There are also links, to Facebook live streams and to YouTube live streams that you will find on the committee page of the House webpage. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I need to go over of technical. I don't think so. Chair Lesh, you reminded me at the earlier meeting that the House is trying to keep these committee meetings tightly to a 90-minute time slot. That's so that we can make sure other committees can then start on time. And so I will be moving to get us to a prompt adjournment then at 2:15, which is the 90-minute mark for our hearing. With that, today's agenda, we have a presentation from the DPS, Department of Public Safety, for a supplemental budget presentation. We also have Representative Mower's bill, House File 4304, which partially flows from DPS, but also from the Attorney General's as a recommendation from the working group that both the Commissioner and Attorney General chaired over the course of the last year. There will be discussion on amendments that have been offered to House File. Let me get the House File number, the one related to the department. House File 4540. We will not, however, have House File 450 formally before us. The president is basically going to have the department walk through its request. At a future hearing, we will lay House File 454, which reflects that request for action by this committee. And at that point, amendments will be acted upon. However, amendments have been shared and posted, and so I've made them available as informational, which means that people can certainly comment to them. With that, the first order of business is to adopt the minutes from our last meeting, which was held last Monday, and I am currently blanking on the date.
April 6th.
Pardon?
April 6th.
April 6th. So is there a motion for adoption of the April 6th minutes?
So moved, Chair.
Representative Ellison moves adoption of the April 6 minutes discussion. And members, we're going to unmute everyone so we can do this by voice vote. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same aye. Side.
And Jeff, you may want to wait one moment for everyone to unmute if that's possible.
All right. Let's try that again. All in favor of the motion to adopt the April 6th minutes, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Very well, motion prevails, and the April 6th minutes of the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Committee are adopted. With that, members, we're going to move to the Department of Public Safety's supplemental budget presentation. As I mentioned earlier, that'll be that's encompassed in House File 4540. However, we're not acting on House File 450 at this hearing. We have Commissioner, I believe we have Commissioner John Harrington, and so I would ask him to virtually come forward and begin his testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Harrington, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Katie Knudsen, the Legislative Affairs Director for the Department, is sharing a screen with you, which has a PowerPoint presentation that we'll be going through as I present the supplemental budget. I want to start by thanking the committee for taking their time and setting up this electronic vehicle so that we can do the social distancing, which is keeping us all safe. The safety is a top priority of the Department of Public Safety that bears that name. The department continues to serve as a critical need for Minnesotans. And during this time of the pandemic, we continue to serve both Minnesotans individually, but just as importantly, we are serving the 87 sheriffs and the 361 local law enforcement, including the tribal police departments, by sharing information and being a relay point for them on public safety concerns throughout. This includes BCA doing investigations with the Fusion Center of threats and tracking, for example, threats to our Asian American community that we have become aware of and other hate crimes that we have become aware of through hotlines that we have been jointly working with through the governor's office, the attorney general's office, and the Department of Human Rights. I would note as we begin to get into the BCA's part of our ask there that it is despite the fact that it seems like we are in a period where we only talk about the virus and COVID and what's going on around it, unfortunately, crime has continued to occur in the state of Minnesota while our focus has been rightfully so on the virus. A couple examples would be a double homicide investigation the BCA completed successfully in Long Prairie, where a retired Minnesota Viking and his wife were killed, and their son, who was the suspect, has been brought into custody. And then also the continued work we've done on the Waseca Officer Madsen shooting. Those are just two examples of, in greater Minnesota, the work the BCA has done, in addition to the work on officer-involved shootings that we've done up until including this last weekend's shooting in Burnsville. When we talk about the BCA, there are, in general, three needs that we believe require additional support that will best serve the state and our partners. And the first is to, which is a slide up now, is to allow for a 24/7 staffing of the coordinated crime and threat reporting system. This system is the hub for all of the spokes throughout the state of Minnesota where information comes in when there is a threat or where there's a crime, where additional information or cross-jurisdictional investigation is required. The clearest example that I remember is getting a tip from one of the national fusion centers, I believe it was from out of the FBI's, asking whether or not we had a Carleton school. And so, yes, there are lots of schools by that name. We actually start checking all of the lists of high schools in the state of Minnesota, and we find that we have a couple of them. The issue is that there was a threat to have a mass shooting at that school, that they could not find a school locally that matched up with the description. The Fusion Center, this 24/7 center, was able to track down where that school was in Minnesota, to contact the principal of that school, find out that they had a student who had been suffering from mental health issues. And fortunately for that school, that student had recently relocated to Florida. But once again, because of the connections that this center has, we were able to contact the Florida city where that student had moved to, and notify them that he was making internet threats about doing a mass shooting. So we really do believe that this coordinated system really does pay benefits. The information is essential that it is being done in real time. And one of the concerns I have is that because the center is only operated on a part-time basis, things that happen in the middle of the night oftentimes sit and wait until the first staff person comes in the morning. And if you can imagine a agency asking at 4 a.m. because they've made a traffic stop or because they've picked up a tip, and having to wait till 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning for someone to pick up the tip and begin to work on it, that is the scenario that we're working under. So we believe that we need to enhance this this asset to being a 24/7 asset. The cost of this request is $1.75 million for fiscal year 2021, and then $1.75 ongoing thereafter. The second item in our request comes directly from the voice of our victims. As you know, we have the Office of Justice Programming, but we also are actively involved in victim services directly through the BCA. There has been obviously a great deal of conversation, both public and privately, around the whole issue of sexual assaults and sexual assault examination kits. Our recommendation is that the BCA be charged with the storage, the tracking, and the testing for sexual assault examination kits. We describe those in two ways, restricted kits versus unrestricted kits. A restricted sexual assault kit would be a kit where the victim is asked for it not to be tested. And an unrestricted kit are kits that could be tested without question. As we look at the volume of the kits that have come in, I look back from just a short time ago in 2010, when we were a little over 650 kits coming in. And in 2019, we were at 1,400 rape kits coming into the BCA. Clearly, we have seen an expansion in the number of kits. We've also seen some challenges as local police departments had to make decisions about what kits they were going to send to us and which kits they were not. Given this proposal, local law enforcement agencies would store the unrestricted kits indefinitely, and the BCA would retain all of the restricted kits for 30 months from the date received, unless the victim decided that they wanted to be converted into a unrestricted kit and allow us to be testing that. The BCA would then utilize a website with a searchable database. This would allow the actual sexual assault victims information on the status of their kit, so they would no longer have to wonder where their kit was in the process. Our request for this proposal is for a total of $3.096 million in fiscal year 2021, and then there is a $2.06 million ongoing request thereafter. Our third request involves the BCA laboratory. I mentioned the rape kits as part of that, but we see this as beyond simply the rape kits. We also see the BCA's lab as being a component in the ongoing fight to allow or to support local law enforcement with violent crime cases. The laboratory has seen an ever increasing demand for its services, and especially in two areas, DNA testing and narcotics testing. Narcotics testing has been going up steadily. And if you can picture this, in 2015, they were testing 5,941 different cases for narcotics. And last year, we almost doubled that. We were at 11,009 cases that we had to test for narcotics. In terms of the DNA submissions, they also have continued to grow and grow and grow. For example, over the last 5 years, we have seen requests for DNA to be analyzed as part of aggravated felony assault cases. It has grown by 22%. We have seen cases in terms of homicides. It has grown by actual homicides by 23%. The numbers for officer-involved shootings where we're looking at DNA has increased by 90%. Weapons cases where they are looking at DNA for that has increased by 47%. Overall, we have seen 1,700 cases more per year that we are now being asked to get DNA out on, and making sure that we can do this in a timely fashion is important, both for the purposes of the investigation and just as importantly for the purposes of the courts, where speedy trials are an essential component. We believe that having this additional resource will shorten the turnaround time. It will also allow us to add additional resources. And that will help allow the local police departments to quickly respond to crime spikes that they're seeing. The request for this is $1.386 million in fiscal year 21 and $844,000 in fiscal year 22 and ongoing. Criminal justice data communications is another topic that we'd like to have discussed. This is a topic that we brought up last year, but we still need to address it as it was identified in a 2018 FBI audit. And it regards the issue of background checks for non-criminal justice agencies. Minnesota Criminal Justice Data Communications Network holds the sensitive data used by a wide assortment of agencies. Some of those agencies have non-criminal justice agencies need to get access to this data without having a computer connection to the BCA. When these non-criminal justice agencies have contractors that perform services on their systems, we are required to have a fingerprint check. And so this would require that if a contractor has access to a federal criminal history record system, they must have a fingerprint-based state and national background check before they're allowed access. And this is simply a policy piece. Finally, we are proposing a package of items that we believe will help reduce violent crime. And this package would be run out of the Office of Justice Programs. The first part of this is we're calling a community-based violence prevention grant approach. These grants would go to community-based organizations and local units of government. We have required as part of this process that they would serve geographic areas that are either underserved and or have high rates of violent crime. The grantees must have involvement by members of the community who serve in a planning, implementation, and an evaluation in the strategies that would be employed. The strategies we believe will require at least one of the following: either prevention strategies that focus on preventing violence through education, trauma-informed services, or improved social conditions in the community; intervention strategies that focus on interrupting the retaliatory patterns of violent crime in communities most impacted by crime; or three, an enforcement strategy that focuses on the identification of individuals, groups, or areas where acts of violence are prevalent in the community. But even then, it must be done in partnership with a community-based organization or a local law enforcement entity. It cannot be done as a one-off. We are recommending $1.5 million in one-time funding for these grants. The second piece of that is a grant that would be issued to form a collaboration between public health departments and community-based social service agencies. This grant really speaks to the issue of the mobility of crime, especially in the metro area, where we see individuals and victims moving across the metro area. And so having a coordinated metro area crime response makes much more sense than to try and deal with this jurisdiction by jurisdiction. This grant would be issued to a collaborative between public health departments and community-based social service agencies, and it would allow for the development of a model for gun violence response that would be used by local criminal justice agencies and advocacy groups, could be used throughout the state. We are recommending $400,000 in one-time funding for this grant. Finally, as I look at the impact of this, we look at needing some statewide oversight and coordination for these efforts. We believe that we are in need of a statewide violence prevention coordinator. And this person would work out of the Office of Justice Programming and would pull together a variety of these different programs that we have just discussed, as well as other programs that are already out there, to try and make sure that we are not unnecessarily duplicating services, and also to make sure that as we look at a gap analysis, that we are not neglecting a community or a need simply by them not having been at the table before. This position would be $100,000 in fiscal year 2021, and it is a one-time ask. With us today, I have the superintendent of the BCA, Andrew Evans, and the director of the Office of Justice Program, Kate Weeks. They are both online and are available to answer questions. And at this time, I would entertain the committee's questions.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner. We do have a member who has a question, but let me begin. I've got several. I won't ask them all right away, so I can give others an opportunity to weigh in. But very quickly, on the last part of the OJP requests, all three of those are one-time requests. I'm assuming, but here's the question, right? I'm assuming that that the reason they're one time is that they're being proposed in sort of a pilot format or a pilot approach, which then could possibly produce valuable information in a form of an assessment that could then lead to a longer conversation about keeping those moving beyond 2021, but maybe my assumption is wrong. So maybe tell us quickly why they're all one-time requests at this point.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right on target. We believe that this would be a pilot approach where we could document both the need and the efficacy of this approach. And so we did not ask for ongoing funding on that. We recognize that this is a novel approach to taking this on from the state. It is something that, as I have been sitting in community meetings over the last now year and change, regularly community groups are asking, what is the state going to do about gun violence? What is the state going to do about violent crime in their communities? And up until now, we have said, well, the BCA is there to support. We have these grants that we send out on a one-time basis or an ongoing basis, but we have not had a coordinated approach to that. And so taking a coordinated approach, this would be a piloted approach, but we believe it is what the community is asking for, and it is what our both public safety and community partners have requested of us.
Yeah, and so, Commissioner, it seems to me there's some really important principles here that I think the department is then forwarding, and I'm obviously going to be repeating, but the need for another level of coordination, of collaboration, a coordination on the part of within the department, of collaboration across different entities. I noticed the public health and community-based organizations, for instance, integration into responding to gun violence, and then a broad geographic scope. We heard earlier this session from Representative Sandstein's bill, some of the challenges, and you even echoed some of that earlier when you began by sharing, you know, the current work that, you know, stretched from Long Prairie to Wasika to Burnsville. And so there's, it sounds to me like there's a real need on the part of the department to recognize that we're not faced with a reality that is only present in one corner of the state, but that there are some issues that need to be responded to in different geographic locations. Let me just very quickly ask one more question, then I'll turn to the others as well. And this has to do, this it piqued my interest on the very first one, the coordinated crime threat reporting. I think you said that that's currently a part-time function. I guess I'm kind of surprised that something like that would be part-time. Maybe if you can just fill in a little bit, you know, the history of that particular activity and why it's currently at one time, and how long have we been engaged in this kind of work of a coordinated crime and threat reporting activity.
And I'm going to turn to Drew Evans to give you more of the details on that. I've been involved in the conversation, what's called the Fusion Center, and it really is a product of post 9/11, when the federal government decided that each state needed to have a fusion center. And there was conversation. I was in St. Paul at the time, but there was conversation statewide about what that would look like. I think in the early days of that, this was federally funded, and then as the federal funding dropped off, the state picked up more and more of that cost. But at some point, we were not able to run it on a 24/7 basis. But Drew Evans can give you more of the details of that. Drew is on, I believe.
Very well, yeah. Director Evans.
Thank you, Chair, members. The Commissioner did highlight the impetus of this after 9/11. There are currently 88 fusion centers around the United States. The BCA operates the Minnesota's Fusion Center. But for us, it's part of a larger group of our criminal information and operations section. These are our information sharing and our criminal intelligence analysts. We have a duty officer that's 24/7, and our communication center is 24/7. But this particular would be looking at that threat report. Reporting. As you've seen, and as we've developed this expertise within the BCA, really think of it as a hub and spoke model. We are the hub, and we get information shared into the BCA, and then it is collected and analyzed, and then is shared back out to law enforcement. And so, for example, on the slide the commissioner had with our COVID-19, there's tons of information that I'm sure many of you have experienced through this time period. We've asked this group then to develop a daily briefing that goes out to all of our public safety partners that analyzes public health data from the World Health Organization, from the federal information that's going on. There's things in there about scams that we're seeing, price gouging. As the commissioner said, looking at crimes against our Asian American citizens in this state to be able to monitor what that is, different crimes that we're seeing and trends around the country. It is currently funded, the Fusion Center, 100% federal, and then we do contribute from the BCA's base budget some funding to be able to house them here, etc. You can't use federal funds to replace that type of stuff. So this would get us to a 24/7 model. They currently are Monday through Friday. 8 to 4:30. They're a very dedicated staff. They answer the phone after hours. But oftentimes when a threat comes up very quickly, we don't have the ability and we're scrambling to get people available to address those particular needs. So this would give us more bandwidth to be able to address those threats as they come up. Same thing we've been working, for example, with our faith-based institutions. Before all this hit and all of our attention was drawn to the COVID-19, the commissioner asked us to be working with faith-based institutions across Minnesota to better share information, collect information to try to keep all of them safe across Minnesota. These are the types of activities they perform.
All right, very well. And again, and I should have been listening a little bit more carefully, Director, but how far back does this particular function?
So it's resided in a couple different places. The Fusion Center itself was implemented in the early 2000s, 2003. There was a lot more federal funding. It's about $700,000 that fund that operation now. The other portions of our criminal intelligence operations, information operations section, they have been part of our investigations division for quite some time. So oftentimes when we're asking you all for additional funding for particular initiatives, we're usually asking for criminal intelligence analysts that support those criminal investigations. They're also in this section. So they have a slightly different function than what this is aimed at.
Okay, very well. Thank you, Director. We'll go to member questions right now. First is Representative Novotny, and then followed by Representative O'Neill. Representative Novotny. And if you're speaking, you may need to unmute.
Commissioner Mariani. Chairman Mariani, Commissioner Harrington, and Director Evans, have there been any thought of adjusting schedules and working some of your analysts on different shifts to cover that time? And has there been any thought of coordinating with Hennepin County and their Fusion Center? I believe they go until 2 o'clock in the morning right now, 7 days a week. Any thought of that? How many full-time employees are we talking about adding with this bill?
Good questions, Commissioner or Director.
I'm going to let Superintendent Evans handle this one. So,
very well, Director Evans.
Yes, Chair and Representative, that's a good question. Hennepin County does not have a fusion center. They have a criminal information, which is aimed slightly different. That is a real-time crime center, which handles different things coming in. I don't know their exact schedule. I will tell you we already coordinate with them on a number of different things when it comes to this type of work. We work back and forth with that. We support a lot of the work they do in terms of the HIDA for Minnesota, et cetera. We have looked at those. There's seven people, though. So there's a very small staff in here that does this work, and it is a very collaborative environment. They need to work together to developing products. They're working with each other, and so there really is the staffing that we have there. We also do put somebody on call right now. They're just not able to address the things that are coming in daily. In addition, these then analysts would be available in those after hours to support those criminal operations going on daily. But we are the one state fusion center in Minnesota.
And Director Evans, the second part of that question, with how many staff are you anticipating?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and members. This would be of 10 additional, or, I'm sorry, it would be 1.7, 14 additional staff. That would get us to that 24/7.
Okay, well, Representative Ivey?
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Commissioner, the second question was about the crime lab. You were asked adding full-time employees into the crime lab for the sex kit testing. How many employees are you looking at adding for that?
Director Evans. So we're switching over to the sexual assault exam kit issue, it sounds like.
That's correct.
Yeah. It's a... 8 scientists for DNA, and then I believe 2 for the tracking portion, which are technicians that they would be. So that would get us to a better, the reason we're scrambling a little bit, that the number has changed a little bit from what we were looking at. That would get us to a better turnaround time when it comes to those.
Thank you, Chair.
And address, I'm sorry, an address, I jump back and forth, and address the anticipated increase for the entire state.
Very well. Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Considine. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for including my bill about rape kits into your presentation. It's nice to see that that is important to the agency and to the governor. My question, though, is I understand that the governor is doing a hiring freeze. And so you just said 14 FTEs for the Fusion Center, 8 DNA scientists, and I believe it was a couple toxicology scientists, if I remember correctly, and then a couple techs to do the tracking system. So how will that be accomplished if the governor has a hiring freeze? I don't quite understand how you're going to accomplish that with a hiring freeze.
There is a provision in the rules that MMB has published that that will allow for especially the Department of Public Safety to identify essential employees that are necessary and to get an exemption from the hiring freeze. And so we would anticipate when we started this process there, we were before, this was started before COVID and before the hiring freeze had come into existence. But we have considered that given the directions we've had from Commissioner Franz, and we would anticipate filing for an exemption from that freeze.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate hearing that. That's very exciting. It's the first that I've heard of that. And being the bill author, I was hoping to hear before a public hearing. I've had multiple people ask me what's going on. So that now I understand what's happening. On another question, I'm wondering about these grants. So you have three different types of grants. But in particular, I'm wondering, Commissioner Harrington, if you could explain to me what is an example of a community-based program or a nonprofit specifically for the first grant that you talked about? And then if you could also explain to me what's a community-based social service agency? I'm out here in rural Minnesota, so I don't know what that means. If you could explain that in relation to the gun violence grant.
Commissioner Harrington.
Representative O'Neill, in Minneapolis, for example, there is a group which is generally referred to as GVI, the Gun Violence Intervention Group. They have contracted with the Minneapolis Police Department and then also with North Point, which is a nonprofit social service agency. The GVI group has worked to identify hotspots in Minneapolis where gun violence has spiked. The North Point group then goes out and does face-to-face interaction with the young people who are most likely both the victims and the perpetrators, offering them resources, including jobs, housing, education, health resources, to give them an avenue to put the guns down. And then together, they with other social service agencies that are then looped in, work to provide the support mechanism so that the young men who would either be victims and or perpetrators are supported as they leave the life of gun violence. So that would be one example. There are several others that I can think of in the Twin Cities area where a community group, a police department, and a nonprofit have partnered together to act on a particular social service need around violent crime.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, are these competitive grants? Are these direct appropriations? Like a flow through to these agencies, these social service local agencies.
I would invite the director of Office of Justice Programs, but my recollection was that these would be competitive grants. They were not a direct appropriation. Dr. Weeks, if you would, if I'm speaking incorrectly, or if you can provide any additional background, I'd appreciate it.
Director Weeks.
Chair members, good afternoon. Kate Weeks with the Office of Justice Programs. That is correct, Commissioner. We would be putting out an RFP, same as we would with any of our other funds.
Mr. Chair, one final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you Ms. Weeks. Can you let me know, are these groups that were just discussed, are these people that we've already, the state's already been working with, or is this a new endeavor? I'm just trying to get a handle on what it is we're trying to do here and with whom and how that whole process works.
Ms. Weeks, Director Weeks.
Chair members, the way that this grant process is being envisioned, it will probably be targeting programs that we don't traditionally fund. And so that's why you see directives on underserved communities or at-risk populations, is really trying to encourage and support those partnerships in communities that are working to address violence. And that is, it's a little more specific and a little more nuanced than our other crime prevention programs.
All right, very well. Chair Considine, followed by Representative Johnson. Chair Considine.
Pass.
Very well. Representative Johnson, followed by Representative Pinto, and then we've got a couple of testifiers in the waiting room that wish to speak on this issue as well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani. Ms. Weeks can answer my first question. Reading the eligibility on Subdivision 2, this looks like there's only three cities in the state that could apply for this grant, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, because it requires a city of the first class. And I'm not sure if Duluth even has a public health department from the city. And so we're down looking. This is just narrowly pushing where this issue is to go. We have issues in other places in the state where we do have some of the same issues with these gun violence. But it's limiting where this money can go to just basically two cities. I'm just wondering if there's a reason for that, and I do have one other question afterwards.
Commissioner?
Representative Johnston, when we began formulating this request, that we were in part responding to the widely reported increase in gun violence, especially in the Twin Cities area. And so that was top of mind, as that was where the community outcry for additional resources and additional solutions was coming from. We do believe that there will be other jurisdictions that will be eligible for this, in addition to Duluth. Rochester area would be another that I believe would also be eligible for this, although I'm not positive whether they are technically a city of the first class or not. But the intention behind this was to try and make sure that the resources would go to where the problem was the most acute and where the need was the most dramatic.
Are we from? No, okay. Everything got really quiet. Nobody was moving. I thought we froze up here. Commissioner, I do recall there was quite a bit of publicity around this. Our minority leader in the House held a major press conference focusing particularly on some tragic incidents or scary incidents happening in, along the LRT line. Representative Johnson, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I did have a follow-up. As far as the way the bill is written, city of the first class, you only have three. And after this next census, I would imagine it would be down to two, with just Minneapolis and St. Paul under the definitions. Duluth is well under that number to be considered a city of the first class. So I imagine they will no longer be classified that after the census. The other issue I'm wondering, we had lots of testimony last year from County Attorney Choi and even an admission from County Attorney Freeman. And we learned that they're not prosecuting a lot of these gun crimes. I'm thinking if we start prosecuting these people that are violating the law and using firearms and charging them out, we might have a lot less of it. I talk to people in the world, not only the cops, I talk to the perpetrators as well. Right now, with the amount, with as quick as they drop the gun charges, they don't care because they don't get in trouble for it. If we start having, start prosecuting those crimes, we might have a better handle on this, and they might think twice about doing some of this stuff because they know if they get caught with a firearm right now, it doesn't matter.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I don't think that's a question for our commissioner. I'm not sure that he's prepared to respond to that in particular. It would be good for us to have, you may be right, you may not be right. It would be good to have data that shows us the relationship of prosecutions and gun crimes relative to violent acts. That's an objectively important thing to have. I'm sorry, Commissioner.
No, I was just going to say, as I've looked across the research nationally in terms of the approaches that have been the most dramatic in reducing gun violence, the approach that we are proposing has been successful in Boston. It has been successful in Chicago at different times. It was successful in Minneapolis. And it unfortunately came and was then, once the problem was solved, the approach was dropped. And now it has been re-picked up in Minneapolis. But from what we can tell, at least from the research, this approach is one of the most effective approaches to reducing gun violence in a community. And that's why we have proposed it as part of our model for statewide solution.
Well, and Commissioner, you're reminding me, I had a conversation just before, we shifted to virtual convenings at the state office building with representatives from the GVI group, and they did share their knowledge of the Boston, I think it was the Boston example.
Boston Gun Project was one of the first great successes of this.
Yeah.
It's a zero gun homicides for several years as a result of this intervention strategy.
Commissioner, I'm just wondering, and I'll move on to the next question, but I'm wondering if perhaps you or your staff could forward us, how we can access, information about that and/or evaluations of the Boston project. It does seem to me that we should be pursuing whatever successful approaches have played themselves out.
I would be happy to, sir.
Thank you. Very well. So then we have Representative Pinto and then Representative Dean, and then we'll move to the testifiers. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know how well I can be heard. I figured I should have put in these headphones and we'll see if it's going to work any better. I did want to make sure to note in response. There we go, perhaps. I did want to note in response to Representative Johnson that in my experience, gun crimes are taken extremely seriously by our county attorney's offices. But of course, they can only prosecute crimes that are felonies. And that was County Attorney Freeman's point, is that the crime in question, when he said we are prosecuting them, is because they're not prosecuted by county attorney's offices, they're prosecuted by city attorney's offices. In any case, my question, though, is relates to the issue of the sexual assault kits. And I've been wondering about this, and this seemed to be as good a time to ask as any. In my experience as a prosecutor, sometimes those kits are not going to make a difference in the prosecution. So an example would be where you have a known suspect who admits to the sexual contact, but has some other defense, as it was consensual or something else. I want to see if the commissioner could comment, or perhaps it'd be Superintendent Evans, about how the proposal works for the, again, in my experience, there's actually quite a few kits for which it would not make a difference for the prosecution to have the kit tested, although certainly many times it would. If we could just have a comment on that.
Commissioner or Director Evans?
I'd like to see if Superintendent Evans can field that one. My experience with this is that, yes, there is a bifurcation of kits where either you know who the suspect is and the suspect is already in custody, and so whether testing that kit immediately may or may not be the most immediate need. But I think Superintendent Evans can speak to those kits where there may not be a prosecutable case.
Very well. Superintendent.
Yes, Representative Pinto and members of the your point is well taken. I think what we've talked though through this as we've been studying this issue both here in our state and across the country is one of the things besides just the actual case at hand that we sometimes are learning is that, say, for example, in your situation that you the hypothetical you pose, that certainly could happen in one situation, but that DNA that may be then uploaded into our state database and then our federal database, if that individual then is accused of a similar crime in, say, a different state, a different locality, that would be then connected. And when you see that happen on multiple occasions, you certainly would then pique the interest of the law enforcement that they maybe need to talk to each other, work through those cases, connect those cases in that way. So this has become something we've learned as a mechanism to really be approaching all these criminal sexual conduct cases in a very holistic fashion from a DNA testing standpoint. And while there may be a few cases where that scenario would end up, that the greater good of overall of holding the people accountable that should be when they are in different jurisdictions really, from our perspective, outweighs any of those individual cases that may occur that you illustrated.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Gein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And I'd like to speak a little bit to the three strategies relative to community-based violence crime and addressing those. And I don't have the language right in front of me. So when we talk about cities of the first class or cities that actually have public health departments, my understanding is that sort of is directed towards the bucket of the $400,000 for that coordination. And if I understand the grants from the 1.5 million, that would be for community-based programs that actually have a relationship with law enforcement. This isn't something that communities are going to go out and do this completely on themselves. This is something that's coordinated. And there are many community-based groups already trying to do this work out in the community, but it really is a lack of resources that are allowing them to actually have robust impact that I believe that they can have. And, you know, relative to, you know, this being in, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul, as the chair mentioned previously, a couple months, might have been less than a couple months ago, you know, there was the press conference about the concern about the incidences of crime in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So I would hope that those individuals that held that press conference about their concern would be completely supportive of this, because the goal is to make these communities safer, but also to make the community safer for those individuals who may not live in the community that might be visiting those communities and doing those things. So that would just be my comment. I think this is a really solid approach that's based on evidence-based research in other parts of the country. And I think if we're going to really try to deal with the issues of public safety, this is something we all should be in support of.
Thank you, Chair Dean. And so three other members have hopped on with questions. We still have a person testifying in the waiting room. I had signaled that we would jump to our testifier right after Representative Dean. However, I'm trusting that these three next questions can be done pretty quickly so that we can get our testifier in and then be able to move on with our agenda. So Representative Long, Representative Lanio, Representative Johnson, then we'll move to our testifier. Representative Long.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Long. Representative Lanio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have something quick follow-up about the rape kit bill. This is something that Representative Mueller and I have spent a great deal of time researching and looking into. And I just wanted to say also, on top of what Superintendent Evans said, is that you also have an issue of people being drugged and then not having very little memory and such of what's happened. A lot of them don't report. And one valuable thing, obviously, is if there is a known, so maybe that perp did it to somebody else that was a consent case, but they've also gone to bars and stuff and drugged women and done it that way. And it helps tie all these different types of cases that are very hard to move forward, as you know, because you're a prosecutor, then they can, you know, it can be moved forward because now you've got connected cases all over the state and maybe all over the nation. So I think it's really important that we take serial rapists off of the streets, and this is one of the best ways we could possibly do that. So thanks for.
Thank you, Representative Aldea. I don't see, I don't have Representative Pinto's picture in front of me, but I suspect he was not in agreement. Representative Johnson, and then we'll move on to our testifier. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot to ask this earlier. We talked about the FTEs for the storage and for the fusion center, but there's also $1.386 million for 2021 for other staff and operating to and train us up for lab capacity. I just wondered how many FTEs that we're talking about there.
Very well. Commissioner or Superintendent Evans?
Six.
This is it would really depend on what the actual funding came through at the end with this particular. It was originally it would be approximately six staff was what it is, and we would maximize that staff. And really, that was aimed at getting those turnaround times down to really acceptable time frames for our DNA turnaround. That's one of those areas, as the commissioner illustrated, we've seen a steady increase in the number of submissions to our lab beyond just sexual assault examination kits and violent crime and others as law enforcement continues to see the value of that type of testing in their investigations. We continually see increases in our DNA and our drug laboratory, as the commissioner had noted. This would be aimed at DNA testing, and then our NIBIN program, which is the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network. It's a tool that we utilize with the ETF to connect shooting scenes. So we enter spent cartridge casings that are recovered from crime scenes, and then they are examined down at a correlation center in Alabama, and it connects those different shooting scenes to provide investigative leads to the law enforcement.
And Superintendent, I really don't know the answer to this. I should, but I've forgotten. Did we make any new investments and make any progress in the last session's appropriations with BCA?
Yeah, drug chemistry laboratory, we were talking about that in the last session. We've hired a number of new scientists that was appropriated. It's allowing us to keep up with the continued increased demand in our drug testing, but that's primarily where the funding went. But it was very much appreciated. Without those, we'd be at two-year turnaround times right now, I'm confident. And so we'd be able to at least maintain with that.
So this would allow us to respond to another area of growth and demand in terms of your lab needs.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. You know, especially with DNA testing, oftentimes law enforcement is waiting to make an arrest and move a case forward until that DNA processing is done. It provides really vital clues and information to move those cases forward. And so the longer that testing takes, it's the more time that somebody is not being held accountable in our system and justice being served to our victims.
Very well. Thank you for the question, Representative Johnson. I forgot to ask that one as well. With that, I'm going to move to our testifier. I believe we have Mr. Flowers, who's available in the waiting room. And then once we hear that testimony, unless there's someone else who's coming forward, then we'll, we don't have the bill before us, and so there's nothing to lay over, but then we'll move over to House File 4304. And so let's see who's in the waiting room. Looks like we have two individuals, perhaps. And I think we're working on the technology to get them connected here.
Hello.
Hello. Who's this?
This is Alicia Smith.
Alicia Smith, welcome to the committee.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate you all allowing me to zoom into your meeting. I am here as a representative of Minnesota Safe Streets, and just to advocate and share the information and the importance of having community-based organizations partnering to address crime and safety. Specifically, what we're initially talking about is in the metro area, where we see startling numbers of just crime in general, and then talk about a statewide effort to prevent and respond to some of that crime. So to have a two-pronged approach with the efforts of addressing every sort of aspect that you can when you talk about crime and safety. As you know, or as you all may be familiar with, Minnesota Safe Streets or Safe Streets had a bill in last session or 2017, I believe. And so we have done some different work and partnered with some local the local law enforcement and state level law enforcement to do some crime prevention strategies, and partnering in Minneapolis and St. Paul in particular very intentionally about addressing some of the issues that we've seen plague not only just downtown Minneapolis, but the statewide. And so one of the things that we've talked about in our approach is the preventative methods of it. We talked about the trauma, addressing the trauma and safety, and lastly, addressing opportunities for employment, which oftentimes is a barrier or is a tool in which why people find themselves engaged in crime as they find it as a last resort for survival. And so I am just here to advocate that we continue to address and invest in community-based organizations to address these issues in the metro and not have it be much more police, but instead that we continue to allow folks that have boots on the ground to do this work, because you can't police or arrest our way out of what we're dealing with.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Smith. Just really quickly, just on that last message, nevertheless, it sounds like that Safe Streets maintains a relationship with the local law enforcement. Is that correct? I mean, and if so, what makes that work? I mean, is there you know, a certain level of trust, respect that's going on here, or what's the nature of that relationship with local law enforcement, and what makes that relationship work?
So yeah, it comes down to a level of trust and building those intentional relationships with the leadership. In particular, we have done some very intentional work in Minneapolis with the Minneapolis Police Department. And so doing some cross training, we've done training with officers where officers have kind of walked us through their approaches and steps to deal with conflict in the community, and doing those in tandem. And so it makes a difference when you have community-based organizations that are doing the boots on the ground work in partnership with the police, and they have that relationship. So when we find ourselves in a tense moment or moment where attitudes or energies are in conflict, that not only can the police de-escalate the situation, but you can lean on the community to do so in your tactics match. And so it's about being intentional with building with the leadership inside of the police department, but also building with the officers who are on the beat and walking throughout the community and seeing that we have commonality and neutral ground for that.
Hey Alicia, Chair Mariani, can I jump in?
Flowers, come on in. Good to hear you.
Yes. First, Chairman, thank you for having this informational hearing so we can let all parties know that this is a crucial time to not mess with resources that's gonna come after this pandemic. As an activist, I'm concerned about what's to come for in our community, in our state of Minnesota. I'm concerned that a lot of the information is still not getting out to people to say that they have to stay apart, the social distancing. And I'm just waiting for the weather to break, and then we'll know more. But I would hope that the legislature would know it's important. Resources are important right now, and the way Minnesota Safe Street is working with, as Alicia said, with Minneapolis, St. Paul, and with the Department of Public Safety. You asked the question about trust. this is the time that the communities do have a lot of trust in Chief Harrington and Assistant Commissioner Hodges, who grew up in one of these areas in Minneapolis, and they know a lot about what's going on. So mine is looking at what's going on, and they stripping the language out of the bill, like they don't want to put the underserved communities, and that's exactly what we are fighting for them that don't know what's going on right now in this pandemic. But we had a pandemic before the coronavirus hit, and in particularly in the African American community, and we still got violence going on right now. And I know your committee should know that robberies are up, things are up. Even though we are supposed to be in the house, you still got a lot of robberies and assaults going on all over the city. So I hope all of us, this can be a bipartisan thing to make sure that that we have the resources when this is over. So I want to make sure that I get that in, and we have built a collaboration across the state to work together, collaborate together, work with the Department of Public Safety, work with law enforcement. And the one thing I think about Minnesota State Street is that we are saying we're going to work with law enforcement. We need both tools here, but we need the community engagement, the intervention and prevention to be done, so we don't have to come back when people are starting to say that they want more law enforcement. Well, we are saying to you now that we're trying to intervene, we're trying to work together, and we need the support. So we should not have anybody saying strip anything away. We actually need more, and I know that's a tough thing to say during this pandemic, but we actually need more, and we need to work together. So I'm saying we're ready, and I thank y'all for giving us this opportunity to talk to your committee, Chairman Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers, and I believe you were referencing the A1 amendment, which we will be talking about in a hearing or two coming up once we have the bill formally before us. And so I want to thank you for being here today, for offering your wisdom, but more importantly, for offering the work that both you and Ms. Smith and the others are doing on the ground. I'm going to move on to the other bill, but Mr. Flowers, very quickly, I've been told I need to do this. I need for you to state your name on the record so that if anyone listens to this, they know who was just speaking. So if you can do that really quickly, I'd appreciate it.
Alfred Flowers, a.k.a. Al Flowers. So Alfred Flowers.
All right. Great.
Minneapolis resident.
Very well, Mr. Flowers. Thank you, and thank you, Mr.
And Chairman Mariani, can I just say that President Belton of the Urban League asked me to organize this because he had some other issues he was dealing with during this pandemic.
Right. No, I know Mr. Belton is very busy, and I know he wanted to be here, so thank you for sharing that. Well, members, we're going to move on then with
thank you.
And I'm sorry, I should thank the commissioner and the superintendent and Director Weeks as well for being here with us today. You may want to stick around because House File 4304, Commissioner, involves some of the work that you've been about as well. But I leave that to your call in terms of your availability. I
serve at the pleasure of the committee, so I'll be here.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner. So why don't we move forward? Representative Boulder, you have House File 4304. I think it's our intent to hear this and lay this over because you've got some amendments that you want us to act on. But in keeping with the spirit of the working group, you want to make sure that you close the loop with them relative to any language that we might move forward. So I believe for now, your motion is that House File 4304 be referred to the General Register. Representative Boland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my motion is that it be laid over.
I think you just said refer to the general register.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. just for some clarity. Yeah,
Let's do it that way, yes. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this bill is a Department of Public Safety bill, and it arose from the recommendations of the Deadly Force Encounters Working Group. The original bill, 4304, has two parts. It creates privacy for peace officers and other first responders, like firefighters, who receive peer counseling after they have experienced trauma at work. They see unimaginable things in the line of their work. The other piece of the bill is requiring law enforcement agencies to provide information required by the FBI to the BCA about the use of force resulting in certain levels of injury. And it's my understanding that that's something that in large part is happening already. This just requires it to happen. Mr. Chair, I do have two amendments, and one of those amendments changes the bill, adds quite a few things to it. So with your permission, I would like to offer those amendments at this point.
Very well. Representative Mueller, which one do you want to do first?
Let's do the easy one first. That one's the A2 amendment.
Very well. Representative Mueller moves adoption of the A2 amendment. This will put the bill in the shape that Mr. Lundy.
And I'm sorry to interrupt the committee. I would just like to note that we may need to formally move the bill to be referred to the general register. And then at that point, we can amend the bill. And then at that point, you as chair can lay the bill over unilaterally.
So let's make sure for the record that is what we're doing. Right now, the motion is to refer House File 4304 to the general register. Our intent is that we're going to lay this over. So that's the motion before us. And Representative Mueller, and that's Representative Mueller's motion. And Representative Mueller now moves the A2 amendment. And I think the way we'll do this, members, is that this is really putting the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be, but certainly will not preclude us from having the conversation about the A2 amendment. So I would ask our members to, for the sake of shaping the bill up, to adopt the A2 amendment. Now, here's what I need to know. Should I do this by, under our rules, by voice vote, or do we need to record this? I think a voice vote works, but...
And Chair, leadership has indicated that it's best to take roll calls for...
Very well. Let's do that. So then the clerk, if the clerk is ready, Mr. Chavez, if you can... take the roll on adoption of the A2 amendment.
Mariani.
Aye.
Edelson.
Nay.
Sorry, can I hear that? Edelson?
Yes.
Okay. Johnson. Johnson.
Yes.
Christensen.
Yes.
Considine?
Yes.
Howard?
Yes.
Howard?
Yes.
Lash?
Aye.
Long?
Yes.
Lucero?
Yes.
Miller? Mueller?
Yes.
Nash?
Yes.
Novotny?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Pinto?
Aye.
Holston?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes. Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
Okay. 17 ayes. It passes.
We have 17 ayes. The clerk reports and saw the motion prevails and House File 4304 is amended with the A2 amendment. Representative Mueller, that was an easy one because that was a pretty simple amendment. The other amendment, do you want to act on that at this point? I don't know if I've not looked at the amendment super carefully. I don't know if that requires a much deeper conversation.
Did you forget about our public safety meeting today?
I'm sorry, Mr. Poston, you're still unmuted.
Sorry. Sorry, Chair.
Quite all right. Representative Muller, your advice on the A4 amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just explain what the A4 amendment is at this point, and maybe we can get some discussion or answer any questions about that amendment and then try to move to adopt that amendment.
That seems fair and wise, Representative Muller.
That sounds great. So, Mr. Chair and members, the A4 amendment is based on language from a similar bipartisan bill that was in the Senate, and it does two things primarily. It expands the list of people who may engage in peer counseling. For example, it adds correctional officers. And the second thing it does is it provides some protections for those who are participating in critical stress management, which is distinct from peer support activity. I do have two testifiers, but I think it would make more sense to have them available to answer questions, Mr. Chair, in the sake of time, so that rather than having them testify, if I need to ask either the commissioner or Officer Vandervoort to answer questions on this, they're both available.
Okay, very well. Members, questions? And that's, well, wait a minute, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because I don't have all of the amendments in front of me, I'm wondering if one of the changes that you made was to either, so to the underlying bill, Representative Muller, on line 2.7, where it says serious bodily harm, is that one of the changes that you made? Because there's not a definition in our statute for serious bodily harm.
Representative Muller, that might have been the A2 amendment.
That's right, Mr. Chair. So Representative O'Neill, that was the A2 amendment, and that amendment changes harm to injury. As you know, assault in Minnesota is defined by levels of harm, but for reporting purposes, the FBI classifies it as bodily injury and has a specific guideline as to what that definition is. And so for the sake of consistency and clarity with the FBI requirements, that A2 amendment changes harm to injury and references the FBI definitions.
Representative O'Neill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that that was taken care of because it's one of the biggest glaring things in the bill, I think, that need repair.
Yeah, sounds like the amendment that you're concerned, Justice. So. Very well. Members, other questions? Okay. So then, Representative Muller, I think we're moving that you're moving the adoption of the A4 amendment.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Muller so moves, and before we'll take a roll call on the motion. The clerk will take the roll.
Mariani.
Aye.
Edelson.
Aye.
Johnson.
No.
Christensen.
Aye.
Considine.
Aye.
Howard. Howard.
Aye.
Lash.
Aye. Vote on Zoom in public speech.
Long.
Aye. So I should probably go back to my committee because I was kind of...
Lucero?
Sounds good.
Pass. Okay.
See ya. All right, bye.
Miller?
Pass.
Moeller?
Aye.
Nash?
Pass.
Novotny?
Pass.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Pinto?
Aye.
Poston?
Aye.
Dean?
Aye.
12 ayes, 1 no, 4 abstain.
That's the count that I have. And so the A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Mueller, you have your full bill before you. I know you did a very quick walkthrough earlier, but do you want to expound on your bill at this point? Or have someone else testify?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, maybe Commissioner Harrington would be able to briefly address the need for this bill.
Very well. As amended. Commissioner Harrington.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. We're happy to see this bill moving forward. As part of the Deadly Forest Encounters working group with the Attorney General, we heard two pieces of information that are included in this bill. One was the need from police chiefs and from rank and file for the need to be to make sure that when officers have seen too much, and when they've had that experience where they need to reach out for help, that this needs to be held private so that they are not discouraged from seeking the help that they need. We heard reports several times from folks that said if they told anybody and it became public, their jobs could be at jeopardy, their assignments could be at jeopardy. And what we do not want is and this is what I heard from the community also, we do not want officers out there, we do not want firefighters out there that are damaged. We want healthy officers, we want healthy firefighters, we want healthy first responders responding, because they can't help anybody else unless they're healthy themselves. And so the privacy piece of this was absolutely, we believe, essential. The second piece of this in terms of collecting the data is also, we believe, an important step forward. About 70% of the departments are voluntarily providing the data so that we know about significant use of force. This would tighten that up so that we would get to 100% or as close to 100% as you can ever get. We believe this is important because it is very, very difficult to find a remedy for a problem if you don't know where the problem is. And so the lack of data handcuffs the Department of Public Safety and others from trying to identify trends where there is an issue in terms of use of force, or where there is an issue in terms of officers needing to use force. So we are very supportive of both of the provisions of this, and we see them both leading to less use of force and more appropriate use of force when it happens.
Very well. Representative Mueller, or are there any questions for the commissioner? Very well. Representative Mueller?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Like I said, I have an officer who is available to answer questions if anybody has questions specifically about the language, but I don't have anything else to add at this point.
You know, I'm wondering, we do have a few minutes, perhaps your testifier, might be willing just to say a few words about the bill.
Hi, thank you, Chair. My name is Mike Vandenbord. I'm the current president of the Metro CISM team, which is the Critical Incident Stress Management team. And our team is comprised of firefighters, paramedics, EMTs, mental health professionals. And I think this bill really helps our mission in increasing participation with members who have been exposed to traumatic events, a critical incident. There's two definitions in the bill. One is kind of geared towards peer supports, and I think sometimes people that aren't familiar with our work blur the lines when it comes to peer support and what we do, critical incident stress management, or CISM. They're kind of two separate entities, if you will. I like to explain it to someone where we're all on the same road, but we have different lanes of the road. Peer support would be focused maybe on a specific agency or an organization on their day-to-day operations, They recognize maybe an employee is struggling with personal issues or whatever. What we deal with is the more critical incident, bad car crash, a bad house fire involving death or a death of a young child that really impacts the responders. That's our job as a critical incident stress management team, is to go out and help the responders move forward in their careers and being able to get back out and respond like Commissioner Harrington spoke about, so they're not damaged. We provide resources and we follow up with responders moving forward, and we try to create a better culture than it was when I first started over 20 years ago, where a lot of times you had to bottle that stuff up. And over a course of a career, that can really be damaging and lead to a lot of other health issues and problems. So we feel that by defining peer support and critical incident stress management, even though we're both going the same direction, we're kind of two different things. But I think overall, this is a great bill for all of our responders, and it provides an arena that will increase participation. So I thank you for your time.
Very well. Thank you, Investigator Vandervoort. I do want to say that I do know that the work that came out of the work group was pretty carefully calibrated. And so I think part of what we're doing today is, as opposed to moving this bill straight away today, we're going to hold on to it after having amended, because the amendments, we want to make sure we're not breaking people's confidence with one another relative to amending language that came out of the work group. And so I, so one, I'm sharing that with you, but also just sort of getting your temperature then in terms of, you know, how we're proceeding, you know, consistent with the desire of the participants in the work group.
Thank you.
All right. Very well. Representative Mueller, I think that's it for your testifiers. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, thank you, Investigator Vandervoort. If there are no other questions, then the chair will lay over, make sure I have the right number, lay over House File 434.
Chair Mariani, I do have my hand up.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, please.
I understand what's going on here. I've, other than probably Representative Novotny, we're probably the only two that have actually sat in these debriefings and de-escalation briefings. They are very helpful to law enforcement, and they're very, and also I've been actually been involved in them with not only law enforcement, but fire departments as well. They do wonders to help the guys that were in these incidents. I do have to apologize for my no vote earlier on the amendment. I was tied up last night and I didn't get a chance to read it. I was reading it and I hadn't gotten through it before I voted no. Because there was a couple of issues I had, but once I finished reading it, there was, it explained it. So I have to apologize for anybody listening for that. Overall with the bill, the first part is no problem. I'm just wondering about the second part, but we'll deal with that later when we bring it up again.
Representative Johnson, that's correct. We'll bring this back forward and we'll have a vote at that time to move the bill forward. Is there anyone else? Any questions or comments? Representative Mueller, this is amazing for this committee. We tend to like to hang around with one another for another 45 minutes or so.
I'm okay with that. I was ready for questions, and Representative Johnson, I just wanted you to know that I'll follow up with you too to address any concerns you have offline before we get this bill back in front of us again.
That's fair.
Yeah, don't blow it.
Very well, then. The chair will lay over House File 4304 as amended. And members, there being no other business. I was just trying to figure out when our next hearing is. it obviously will be next week sometime. So please, you know, stay tuned, and we'll let you know as soon as possible. With that, then the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform in the House stands adjourned.